In the early days of the 21st century, a group of Jewish parents in my Waldorf school, Green Meadow Waldorf School, located just outside of New York City, asked me to give a talk about religion in the Waldorf School. And this came about partly because of a difficult situation that arose in Green Meadow. In fact, that tended to arise in Green Meadow annually, or at least once every 2 years, and that arises in virtually every private Waldorf school, certainly in the Northeast, every year or so. And this is the kind of crisis around the Advent garden and the celebration of Advent, and then perhaps if a school does the shepherd's play, and whether there should be an Advent calendar in the classroom, and whether there should be a creche with every few days new figures appearing until finally just before vacation begins, the little Jesus child is made manifest there. Does this belong in a school that claims to be secular? Now, for further reference, you're welcome to go, whether you're Waldorf connected or not, to the lecture that I am giving on Waldorf education in this sequence. But I just want to speak about this because it's very germane, connecting what I'm about to talk about in this segment on evolution. So I agree that I would give this talk. I should say that my colleagues were, with almost maybe two or three exceptions, who were kindergarten teachers, very interestingly, almost everybody else was virulently opposed to this, saying that it would really upset the parents, that it's bad enough this crisis arises every year, but at least we can kind of put it to sleep. People forget. Rather than, you know, how can we meet this? How can we make a virtue of necessity. Anyway, over and above their opposition, I went ahead and did it. And in the course of the questions session concerning the first lecture, Religion in the Waldorf School, arose the question from parents, exactly what did I mean, or does Steiner mean, by Christianity anyway? What is this Christianity that you all say isn't the same as is practiced by most churches, is not the same thing you see on television? Well, then, what is it? And in response to this, I gave two more lectures, one of them called Cosmic Christianity, the next one, Christianity on Earth. Now, what I have done is I have made links to these three lectures as part of this course. I'm not going to settle these issues to anybody's satisfaction, including my own, in a 15-minute or half-hour segment, or even in several 15 half-hour segments. It's a very big issue, and there are things that simply have to be developed. And even what I did in the course of these four and a half hours of lectures, the three lectures I gave, I confessed was still just sort of the icing on the cake, because this subject of what is Christianity was one that occupied Rudolf Steiner profoundly for at least half of his life. He himself was not deeply connected to the issue, to the question at all, until he came into his 30s. And then something very, very different appeared before him as his task. We'll speak about that when talking about Rudolf Steiner's life and times. So These three lectures are labeled and linked, and you're very welcome to listen to them. Each one of them, as I say, is an hour and a quarter, an hour and a half. And of course, it's a very different mode of presentation because it was a live lecture given to live people, unlike this, which is a recording given to, I assume you're all live out there, but whether you are or not, I wouldn't know. So it's a very different approach. But there I'm able to go into much greater detail and build up a number of things that I could not do here. So giving you those lectures to listen to gives me a little freedom to sort of work with some of the more salient points about this issue. So let's just review, going back to the previous 11 segments on evolution. I don't know how it got to be that many, but anyway, the process of condensation, going from the warmth of Saturn finally to the hard coldness of the mineral world on Earth. The fact that evolution for the human being is an increasing process of condensation, mineralization, we might say hardening and fixing of at least the human physical body, and that this is necessary and this is good, because this hard ground, this flint we might say, is what we need for the steel to strike of our spirit so that the flint can be ignited, that the flame, the spark can rise up. We need that hardness. However, like anything else in the cosmos, it also needs to always have compensatory forces around it. There needs to be a balance, a lightening, a lifting, a softening, something that brings it into movement again and again. And do we can be sure in part to the plan that was inherently there in the cosmos, but also due to extenuating circumstances that perhaps were not so clearly laid out or prefigured, even by God himself. That's a possibility in Steiner's cosmology. It happened that the intervention, particularly of luciferic beings from one direction, Ahrimonic beings from another, and a whole host of beings connected with them, even on the Earth itself, we could say in the elemental world, something that I barely have touched on, an element of over-densification, a rush towards calcification, a heightening of the forces of fixity arose, which would be disastrous in the course of Earth evolution, because it finally had the potential of making the Earth a foreign body, which instead of being the reflective mirror of the hierarchies, would instead be a dark hole for their perception, would have no significance or meaning for them whatsoever. And according to Steiner, that by this central point of Earth existence, so we're now talking about 100 BCE, let's say, at that point, this was already happening for some of the highest hierarchies. They were beginning to lose sight of the Earth itself. Now, if you read what modern astronomy has to say about black holes, very interesting, that it's, of course, completely theoretical. It's completely extrapolated from phenomena on the Earth and information that we receive, the data that we receive through instruments which are built to meet the conditions of the Earth. But nonetheless, we're told that though these are holes and that they are empty, on the other hand, there are tremendous forces of condensation within them. That somehow, in the total emptiness of space as it is presented to us by modern astronomy and physics, in a hole that is even emptier, as it were, there are forces of greater condensation, so that no matter as we know it can really exist there because of the pressure that would be around it. So it's often said that the entire Earth, all of the weight, all of the substantiality of the Earth, could be condensed in a black hole to an object the size of a walnut. And that walnut would weigh as much as the entire Earth does now. Well, from the point of view of the spiritual world, that's exactly what we are. We are a place where somehow matter coalesces under such incredible external pressure and through such incredible internal force that that which is light and spiritual and buoyant out there in the heavens becomes completely filled with weight and materiality on the earth to a point where for them it is a whole. It's a big drop off into nothingness, as it were. So this is what God, we could say, God and his helpers, the highest hierarchy, knew that they would be up against, and something that they had to avoid. And so very early on in Earth evolution, long before the Earth itself condensed, already the highest forces of the hierarchies were sent to begin moving towards the Earth, to be forming, even in these earliest times, something of a balancing force, something of an equilibrium-giving force to counterbalance the increasing densification of matter, also to establish a balance with those forces that would simply pull humanity away from the condensing completely, and in this way also defeat the purpose and the meaning of evolution, which was to allow a certain class of spiritual beings, man, to exist under conditions of great materiality. So the balance had to be maintained. And so those beings who carried those unnamed, only numbered higher principles, which Steiner describes in their totality as the cosmic lamb, that lamb-like being, then a quintessence of it, its essence, began to move slowly but surely towards the Earth, which was not the Earth yet at all. So this is something one might imagine at this level of hierarchical existence, past, future, and present are all one. So on the one hand, no, the Earth doesn't even exist. It's only Saturn and maybe not even Saturn yet. On the other hand, the Earth is already there and it's already occupying its particular coordinates of space and time for these beings who we could say manifest as this being, this cosmic lamb, who's a completely cosmic being. And what he does, little by little through the course of these many eons of time, is to move, as it were, spatially speaking, downwards in a kind of gentle curve through the hierarchies to the Earth. But he remains with hierarchical beings, resides with them as a means of beginning to accustom himself to being less cosmic and more turned towards the Earth. He cannot just do this in one big jump. This would be impossible to bring that degree of materialization. We can say, in the end, in fact, when this being finally incorporates into a human body, his experience, or the experience of the fullness of this being, who is many beings, we might say, expressed as one, his experience of incorporating a human body would be like your experience or my experience of at this moment having to incorporate in a pebble. To be in a pebble, to be thinking the way we think, to be seeing the world the way we see it and so on, but to be completely imprisoned in a pebble. To have no possibility of any movement beyond that and no possibility of action. Simply to be there with a consciousness that's quite accustomed to much more mobility, freedom, and possibility. That was what it would mean for this being, and he was well aware of this. And in fact, part of the reason also that his journey took so long was that he had to wait until conditions of earthly density were at their greatest. So it would not have been appropriate for him to incarnate in ancient India, Persia, Egypt, even Greece. He had to wait until Rome ruled the world, that he would incarnate in a place that was strongly Roman in nature, because they were, as it were, the masters, finally, of the physical world, the Roman Empire, and he would have to incarnate in a place that was most under the sway of earthly gravity. That is to go into a deep valley, quite a bit below sea level. And certainly the Holy Land, today's Israel, has that place within its borders. So he stopped at the level of the seraphim, cherubim, thrones for a long period of time. And then as Earth evolution progressed, he moved through the second group, the spirits of wisdom, the spirits of movement, the spirits of form. Very, very important period, because this is also when he was, as it were, in connection and communication with Yahweh, the being who had the responsibility of separating out the ancient Israelites from all of the Luciferic influences around them. He, in other words, at this moment, was looking down at the earth and beginning to consciously work with Yahweh to create what? An hereditary line for himself. He was going to create the grandparents, great-great-grandparents, great-great-great, and so on, that whole line that he needed so that they would finally result in the body that he needed. So the very same triangle, that right angle triangle that I showed you in the journey, or if you try to look at that motion sickness-inducing journey from one life to another, and that moment when the spirit is able to touch the earth, even though it has a long journey still to go towards reincarnation, but it touches the earth just enough that it begins its hereditary line. So this being, this cosmic lamb, whom of course Steiner speaks of as the Christ or the Christ principle, and here we have that word principle again, the combination of all of those unnamed principles, numbered principles, he speaks of now as the Christ principle. He's looking down on the earth, even as he's also looking towards a future earth when his time will come to incarnate. And then he spends a period of time on the sun, and in a way unites himself with that body of light and warmth. Now this whole time, and this is one of the remarkable revelations that Steiner gives, this is particularly in his book, Christianity and the Mysteries of Antiquity, that different peoples, different cultures, in their own way, in their own time, were perceiving this being and they were seeing him where he was at the time. And this is particularly why, for example, in ancient Persia, and still again in ancient Egypt, the sun and the sun god, this is such an important principle for them, because Zarathustra in particular perceived what he called the aura of the Christ. He didn't call him the Christ, but the aura, Ahura Mazdal, the aura of light that he saw in the sun. So that for a period of time, the Christ revealed himself as the highest of gods among the godlike pantheons of the different peoples. He was seen as a completely different principle working that ruled over but did not yet intervene among the Luciferic spirits who otherwise held sway. So now he was coming from the sun, closer and closer to the earth, and meanwhile, at the same time, so this spirit is coming, but the bodily hereditary line is also moving forward, just as I showed you in that diagram. The two legs of the right triangle are extending in a certain way, and the hypotenuse is moving towards them to finally create the triangle. And this is, and I speak about this in the lectures, I'm not going to go into great detail, but this is where we have, again, Rudolf Steiner, the great prophet of polarity in a way. He says that there were actually two Jesus children. We could say that one of them was more connected to the physical, etheric, hereditary line. And he speaks of this as the Solomon child. And here we have the genealogy that particularly interests Matthew in the Gospel of Matthew. Matthew, who was, among other things, responsible for convincing the Israelites, the Jews, that Christ belonged to them, that Jesus was one of theirs. So he shows the hereditary line that he goes back to David and Solomon, David's father Jesse, the tree of Jesse, so that we have a being here who has a clear genealogy, who then lives very strongly, helping to form the body that he will need in all of its purity, in all of its separation from Luciferic forces. And this will be one of the Jesus children. And because he comes from royal lineage, though he will be born to Joseph and Mary, who are in a way, you know, fallen greatly, like Israel itself, from the time of its glory and wealth, nonetheless, he is the child who is visited by the kings. He is the one who has the star shining over him. He is the one who carries this strongly kingly, priestly nature. Meanwhile, at the same time, the Christ force, the sort of astral ego, and way beyond that, many other bodily principles, many other bodies, as it were, is streaming down from on high, is coming in a very different direction, not horizontally across the hereditary line, but is coming step by step through the planetary spheres, and finally passing through the sphere of the moon from which Yahweh is working on the Israelites, comes to the earth. And though he is working, living in, coming into a body that has been formed by the hereditary line, this body also, as it were, carries within it aspects of the Adam Cadman being that I spoke of in the earliest stages of evolution, the collective plurality of beings who were not able to incarnate in the densifying time of Lemuria, the plurality, the plethora of beings who have been waiting to incarnate on the earth but could not face the densifying, condensing forces. They come to the earth now because the possibility is arising of the earth starting to become spiritualized again, of this process being reversed, if not immediately, certainly, but little by little. And here Steiner speaks of the Adam Cadmonic force, which initially has to come through another child. And this child, because Adam Cadman has not been on earth, does not have the worldly wisdom of the priestly Solomonic child and kingly Solomonic child, but rather comes with tremendous innocence, truly lamb-like into the world, with this sweet innocence completely new to the earthly plane. And so it is that it's appropriate that it will be the shepherds who see this being, the shepherds who visit him, and the shepherds who come to understand his nature. So this, Steiner explains, is why there are two nativity scenes. Though, of course, in most creches worldwide, one sees the shepherds coming from one direction, the kings from another. But Steiner says it's even more differentiated than that. These are two children born at slightly different times, with parents who have the same names. And he said that there have been paintings of these two children that very often later on, without getting into conspiracy theories here, but artists were directed to, as it were, make one of the Jesus children look like St. John, who was a third figure, Jesus's cousin, or to eliminate that second child altogether. But here and there, particularly in Raphael, in his many Madonnas, we see a figure who is very unlikely. None of the iconography points to this being St. John, yet there he is, a little bit older than the Jesus child on Mary's lap, looking at him adoringly, and their faces are quite similar. So, along with Steiner's many other amazing polarities and divisions of things into two, this is perhaps the biggest one. This really takes the cake, as it were. And this is, again, because of the complexity of this issue and because it is so shattering, not so much to somebody like me who was raised Jewish, who, you know, didn't get with my mother's milk the story of Jesus again and again, but especially for those who have been raised Christian and have gone to Sunday school and have, you know, this lives deeply in your etheric body, these images, again and again, of the one child. So I will go on with one more segment on evolution, number 13, finishing this picture a bit. And as I say, please, if this interests you at all or confuses you or both, please do have a look or a listen, those lectures to which I referred you earlier.